Happy Writer. This is a podcast that aims to bring readers more books to enjoy and to help authors find more joy in their writing. I am your host, Marissa Meyer. Thank you for joining me. One thing making me so, so happy this week is that my final copies of Gilded arrived yesterday, and it's always just such a joy opening the box for the first time, seeing the finished final beautiful book. And I, of course, you love all of your books, but there is something about the design of this one that I am just delighted with. I think it is so pretty and kind of spooky at the same time. And I just think the design team did such an amazing job. So I'm so excited to finally have them in my hands. And I know this episode isn't going up for a couple of weeks, so I hope by the time it is airing and you are hearing this, that a lot of you will have gotten your copies as well, and we can all squeal together because I'm so excited that it's finally almost here. And of course, I am so happy to be talking to today's guest. As a child, she immigrated from the West African nation of Ghana to the wild jungles of Maryland. Her debut novel, A Song of Wraiths and Ruin, was an instant New York Times bestseller, and its sequel, A Psalm of Storms and Silence, just came out on November 2nd. We got to share a book birthday this year. Please welcome Roseanne A. Brown.
Thank you so much for having me. And like, yes, that fresh out of the box feeling is just so amazing. I actually cried the first time I opened my box of debut books. I didn't cry this time, which I think is an improvement. So
I totally cried when I got Cinder all so many years ago. I don't think I've cried since then, but it does not stop feeling incredible to like hold something and know I made this.
Yes, yes, exactly. And it's just like, it almost doesn't feel real because like you always experience your story, at least for me, like on a screen, and that's like, it's a physical thing. You can touch it. What?
I know. And then it feels so official. Like, wait, this is going to actually be in bookstores. People are actually going to read this.
Same. Yes. I hope the feeling never goes away.
Yes. No, I know. I mean, it hasn't for me. And I know of authors that I've talked to who are well into their career. They seem to like hold on to that magic. This is such a special moment because even though you're many books into it, like you still had to work so hard for every one of them. It never stops feeling like this huge accomplishment, at least for me.
Yeah. Like, you know, that saying, I don't know who said this first, but like, you never learn to write a book. You only learn to write the book you're writing.
Oh gosh, that is so spot on.
Exactly. So I can see like each one feels like a different kind of triumph because for me, I have, well, technically by the time this is out, I'll have two out. As of right now, I have one out, but like I'm working on my fourth. And it's just like every time it feels like you finish one book, you're like, I got this. It cannot get any more difficult. And then you start the next one, you're like, oh.
No, it truly is. I keep thinking I'm going to get to a point where like starting a new project isn't terrifying, but no, every time you're facing off, you know, this blank notebook or blank Word doc or blank Scrivener, like you're just like, I don't know. How did I do this? I don't remember.
Exactly. Yeah.
But you do write it, and somehow we keep churning out books. So we must be doing something right.
Here's to that. And may it continue.
Yes. So some listeners who follow me on Instagram, I hope, are already familiar with you and your work because we did a really fun Instagram takeover a few weeks ago in which there was a day where you got complete control of my Instagram feed. So that was kind of neat and different. And I feel like having gone through and read your posts and watched your stories, I feel like I got to know you so well through that.
Oh yeah. I'm so glad you had a good time. And your fans were so like, they were so excited and so kind though. I think a bunch of people misunderstood when I said like, ask me, Rosie, a question. Cause I definitely got a lot of questions like, why did you kill XYZ, XYZ? And I'm like, I didn't do that, y'all. I can't help you. I'm sorry.
Oh no, that's funny. I know. I put on my stories here because I'm having my agent on. Actually, her episode, I think, might air before yours, but regardless. And I put on my stories, like, if you want to ask my agent any questions, you can post them here. And a lot of those were also for me, which, like, cool, but yeah, that's not what we were going for. Anyway, so thank you for joining me on the takeover, and it was really fun.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for hosting me. And it's just always just so great to, like, be able to talk to new readers and, like, just talk about the work, because there's still always this moment where you're just like, oh gosh, like, does anyone want to hear me talk about my book for the 19th millionth time? And, like, just finding a new person who's like, wow, that's so cool. It's just a great feeling.
Yeah, no, definitely. I know what you mean. I totally start to feel like a broken record at times. Mm-hmm. So on that note, I definitely want readers to get to know you better. And so I'd love to start by hearing, what is your origin story? What brought you to this point in your life with your second book coming out?
Okay. So my origin story, you touched on it a bit. I was born in Ghana, but I was raised here in America. I immigrated when I was about 4 years old. And the thing is, and, like, an important detail about me is I actually did not speak English when we came here. I spoke our native language of Chi, right? Which is one of the Akan languages. And so my first couple years in America, I did not speak English. I was having a very, very hard time adjusting. My teachers were, like, calling my parents, like, oh, Rosie, she does not understand what's going on in school. Like, she can't keep up with the other kids. We might have to hold her back. And it was all very, very scary, very frustrating. Like, I was very young, around four, but I still... More than, like, memories of that time, I remember this feeling of just disorientation and, like, the world had just changed overnight. And so kind of when things started flipping for me, I must have been, like, around second grade or so. And I remember, like, I was in BJ's. I really wanted this stuffed dog that they were selling in BJ's. And I remember, like, I was telling my mom in tree. I was like, mom, I want the dog. I want the dog. I was doing that annoying kid thing. And she was like, okay, if you can go over to the table where they sell the books and you can pick up one book in English, read it all the way through and tell me what it's about, I'll get you the dog. So I stomp over, like, ugh, fine, mom. So I stomp over there and I pick up the book. And the book at the time, it was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which I must add that I have a lot of conflicting feelings about this series in this day, especially with a lot of the transphobia surrounding it. But back to the, like, what it was back then, it just opened my eyes, like, wow, you can put words on a page and it can mean something to people. Oh my goodness. And it just blew my mind. And honestly, I never actually got the dog. So I need to, like, go back to my mom about that, because, like, I just fight her about that. But, like, it just, from then on, I just started reading everything. It was like just this flip switched in my head. And, like, my teacher was like, what happened? Like, last week, like, Rosie would not say a word. And now she's just saying all these words, like, the other students don't know what's going on. Like, I was just obsessed. I just kept reading and reading and reading. And I reached the point where I just wanted to stop consuming reading. I'm like, I want to do what my favorite books are making me, like, how they make me feel. I want to make other people feel like that. And so it became a thing where it was just like, writing was just sort of the way I communicated with the world and the way I was able to, like, sort of come out of that shell and really start to, like, put my thoughts in order and process them.
That's incredible. So you didn't get the dog, but no, you got something even better.
I still want the dog, though. it's more the principle of the thing at this point. It was like maybe like $8, but I didn't deserve it. But yes, I did get something better.
I think it's hilarious that you picked up that book. Like, that seems like a really intimidating choice.
I think, honestly, it comes down to the fact, because I didn't fully understand what it was, that's why I picked it up. Because, like, yeah, second grade's a bit early for that kind of book. But, like, that is a situation in which my lack of understanding kind of worked in my favor. Cause, like, if I had known, I probably would have picked up, like, a board book or something, but I was just like, these all look the same to me. I'm just going to grab one and try to get her off my back.
So, okay, mom, I'll play your game.
Exactly.
So then at what point do you think that you started to seriously consider, like, I want to be a published writer. I want to have my name on these bookshelves.
Ooh, I know, because this was back, I think this was back in high school, and this is when The False Prince by Jennifer Nielsen came out. Like, before that, I had written some stuff. I wrote a lot of fanfic growing up, a lot of Animorphs fanfic, and, like, a lot of short stories. But that book, I'm really looking at my bookshelf right now. It's staring at me. And I just remember, like, my mind was just being blown apart with like the twists and the turns and like the unreliable narrator and everything happening. I was just like, oh my goodness, like just this feeling like you can do this in a book. I'm like, I want to do this in a book. Like, I want to make a book that does this. Like, I think that was a moment it switched like in high school then. And I remember I gave my first attempt at writing a novel then. I got 20,000 words in before I'm like, I hate this. And I said, actually, another fun fact, Race is actually my first attempt at writing a novel where I got all the way through. So like,
nice. Even though
yes. So I'd attempted before, but I never actually finished. So it's technically the first book I ever wrote. So
yeah, Cinder for me was also the first one that I was able to get to the end, but I also wrote a lot of fan fiction. How much do you think fan fiction played into your development as a writer?
Oh, 100%. Because I think what was great about fanfic is like, you could sort of get instant feedback. And like, as anyone who posts fanfic know, like sometimes it's not always useful or helpful, but like there's a lot of people who have very thoughtful, very like, you can tell they really understood what you were going for. When they're leaving their comments behind. And on top of that, it's like, the stakes are so much lower. Like, cause I'd also taken like writing workshops in school and like sharing work in class. And like, there's just always something more sort of fraught about sharing your own stuff.
Yes.
But like with fanfic, like I don't really own the Animorphs. Sorry, Kay Applegate, right? I'm sorry, Kay Applegate. But like, there's always this feeling. So there's a level of detachment, but there's still that ability to really hone in on your craft and really say, oh, this story worked with people because of XYZ element, or I didn't execute that element quite well. So I feel like on a craft level, the fanfic was so, so useful as an arena to really like learn the ropes where it didn't feel that like big a deal if I messed up.
Right. No, I totally know what you mean. And I also credit fanfiction hugely with the writer that I became. So I know very much what you mean.
Right, it was Sailor Moon fan fiction, if I recall.
It was indeed.
Ooh, who's your favorite Sailor Scout?
Jupiter.
Mm,
you?
For me, Venus. I love Venus.
She's probably my second. Yeah. I always felt like Venus was the most like me. So connected with her a lot. But Jupiter was the one I wanted to be the most like, I think.
That's so funny. Because for me, I think Mercury is actually the one most like me, but I wanted to be Venus.
Uh-huh. Okay, on that note, let's talk about your epic duology. Would you please tell listeners about A Song of Wraiths and Ruin and the sequel that just came out, A Psalm of Storms and Silence?
Yeah, sure, definitely. So A Song of Wraiths and Ruin is inspired by West African folklore, and it came out of my desire, like I mentioned earlier, I love fantasy. I love the epic world building, the characters, the stakes. But as much as I love those books and devour them, I had a hard time finding books that centered around Black kids like me. And on another level, like so much of the fantasy I knew was also based on the oral storytelling traditions of my culture, because like Anansi is the very famous one, Anansi the trickster figure. But there's just so many folk tales of like epic warring kingdoms and like so much history of sort of pre-colonial Africa and all the things that were happening there before European colonization came. And so I was like, what happened if you took a series that like had a lot of the traditional epic fantasy tropes like readers have come to expect, but you pulled in these elements of West African culture that I knew so well. And so Wraiths became the book that I used to explore that back. I started that early 2016. And so the actual premise of the story is it follows two protagonists, a refugee named Malik and a princess named Karina. And so when Malik's younger sister is kidnapped by a vengeful spirit, he strikes a deal with the spirit that to win her freedom, he must kill Karina, the crown princess of the desert nation of Zaran. So he enters a competition to win Karina's hand in marriage so that he can get close to her, marry her, and then kill her so he can save his sister. However, Malik is not aware that Karina's mother, the queen, has just been assassinated. And to bring her back, she's discovered a forbidden spell that requires the heart of a king to bring her mother back to life. Because there is currently no king because her dad is dead and she's technically the queen now, she has only set up this entire competition so she can find some dude, marry him, kill him, and then bring her mom back to life. So yeah, he's trying to kill her, she's trying to kill him. Neither of them are very aware of this. And the book is about it's a dual POV, so we see both their points of view, and it's sort of about the way they circle and maneuver around each other. And then what happens when they actually meet and both the things they think about each other sort of don't match the reality, and basically their plans go off the rails. And so there's also like lots of dark magic, like there's lots of gods and like trickster spirits. And so, yeah, that's A Song of Race of Ruin.
That is an excellent description. It is one of those books that is just a tangled web of deceit and betrayal and love. And yes, I loved this series. Without giving too much away, I do feel like I need to have words with you about a particular character's death at the end of book one.
The funny, we're about to have a spoiler chat. It will happen by the time it airs.
I know, but I don't want to have a spoiler chat. I'm just saying. Yeah. I was come to spoiler not chat happy. Yell.
No, it's that one. Here's the thing. The funny thing is, readers took that death harder than I thought they would, because I really thought that readers would not get this. I think that's one thing I'm underestimating, how connected readers get to side characters, which I'm not sure why, because like a lot of my favorite characters are side characters, but I just really thought like no one was gonna care that much, and like people care a lot, as I've learned, and they're just like, oh crap, I'm like, oh no. So in book two, the character who dies obviously is, well, I shouldn't say obviously, because this series is about necromancy, so like it's not obvious they're not there, but I do try and think we get some good closure on what happened to them. But no, yeah, people, it is both heartening and, well, it's mostly heartening that like how it did, the characters, people were so invested in their death.
Yeah, no, truly. I listened to the book on audio, and I have a really distinct memory of being like working out back in my like little workout room in the back of our house. And that moment happened and I gasped and dropped my dumbbell and turned and just stared at my phone like utter betrayal.
Oh, you could have broke your foot doing that. Oh, no.
Anyway, but of course that's like, that's the goal, right? You want people to feel something. So you nailed it. You succeeded in making me feel so much feels.
Thank you. Like, you know that Marie Kondo like gift from her show, like where she's like, I love mess. That's me. Like that, I feel like that's my philosophy as an author. Like, I love mess. If I could take a situation and make it worse, I will. And so like, that's definitely my intention with that character's death, was like, what would make things that are already bad even worse at this moment? And it was that.
Well, that is a perfect segue into one thing that I really wanted to talk to you about, just the idea of stakes and having big stakes for your characters. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that just really hooked me in book one, is that we've got these two protagonists and you have given them some of the highest stakes and like character motivations of just about any book that I think I've ever read. Like, they are both working so hard to complete this awful task where they both are planning to murder the other one. And of course, as a reader, you don't want them to succeed. And yet you totally understand what is driving them to do this. And they're both just caught up in these awful catch-22s. And it's just like pulling on those heartstrings like every page. So I want to know, like, did you kind of know early on what was going to be driving both of these characters? Or was there like one story that came to you really quickly and easily, and then you had to kind of like develop the opposing subplot, or kind of how did that work out in the process?
So it was definitely the second one where one came first and then the other. And I actually remember the exact moment where I had like the very spark of the idea for Wraiths. I was walking back to class after back in college. I remember thinking to myself, I was thinking a lot about sort of mental health and mental illness and the way it worked. And I remember having the exact thought to myself, wow, if a ghost took over my brain right now, they'd be like, you have a lot going on in here. I'm not sure I want this. Like, you can have this back. Here you go. And it's like, sounds so funny now, but it sparked this idea, like, what would happen to like someone that actually happened to like this world? Like, what happens when you take the supernatural and like you throw in mental health and you throw in, because in so much fantasy, it tends to be like a metaphor, like, oh, when the character is anxious, they shoot lightning, like with Frozen, you know, like how Elsa's powers are like a metaphor for sort of depression, or however you want to see that. But I really wanted it to be very literal. I want to see a character who is dealing with serious mental health issues and dealing with the supernatural. So that became Malik. And so from the start, I sort of knew Malik would be this very anxious person who was dealing with the fact like he could see spirits in this world where no one else could. And that has sort of, people have convinced him he's crazy because of this. And like, he starts to believe it, even though the reader knows he's not. These are very real spirits. But then, and I knew like for him, it was his sister was the motivation. Like these are, he has two sisters and like, they're the only people who really understand him. And like that motivation would be very strong. But then like, as I was going through it, like I was realizing the story was sort of missing something. And I realized we needed a counterpoint because Malik only knows so much. And we just needed to see so much of the world than he himself could actually see. And I think Karina just became the natural counterpoint. Like I was like, okay, then who can give us the best other side of the story? And I'm like, what about this princess he's trying to kill? Mm. And so it just, especially because their social classes are so different. They're seeing just two, they're not even just two different people. They're seeing two sides of this world because she's so privileged, he's not. And so we're seeing like the privileged, the unprivileged, like just the different divides there. And actually in the early draft, Karina actually wasn't trying to kill Malik. Like in the very, I think the first two drafts maybe, she was actually just trying to uncover who had killed her mom. So like while he was trying to kill her, she was more on like a murder mystery hunt kind of thing.
Interesting.
It was fun, but it just kept, I kept being like, no, something's missing here. Something's missing. And I'm realizing like, oh no, she needs to be as focused on him as she is, he is on her. And it just made sense. Like, well, what if she thought she could bring her mom back? And if she thought she could do it by killing him? And so it just, at that moment, everything clicked. Like, oh, these two are very revolved around each other. And like that, from there on, it just kind of built.
Oh, how interesting. You would never imagine. I mean, it's so hard to picture what the story became as not having that element because it was so central in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think in the early one, it's because like, it was more Malik's story originally, but once Karina was in there, like Karina, she's a very demanding character. As those who've read her know, like there was no way, like it could just be his story and she's the love interest. I'm like, no, we need, there's like a reason, like it's a very strict alternating POV. Like there's always him, then her, then him, because mm-hmm. I really wanted them to be co-protagonists. Like it's very much, it started as his book, but it's very much their book now.
Yeah. No, and I loved it. I loved being, I mean, I loved both characters, but the chapters from Karina's perspective, she's just such a vibrant character. And I love that you have this princess who, like a lot of people in her circle, don't necessarily hold her in the highest regard. And yet she herself has such a powerful sense of self and confidence that she was just like unshakable. And I loved that. I loved seeing a character like that.
Yes, Karina's so fun because like between the two, I'm definitely more like Malik. I definitely doubt myself a lot. And so like with Karina, writing her was definitely more like tapping into, okay, when I was 17, like what kind of person do I want to be? I'm like, I want to be someone like Karina, like not necessarily someone who does everything right because she messes up a lot, but like things definitely roll off her back very easily. And I just, mm-hmm. like, I think a sense of self, like you said, I think that's just such a great way to describe it. Like Karina is like so sure, like even when things mess up, she doesn't really give up. And I think that is sort of her best trait. And like you said, yeah, a lot of people in her circle don't really like her. And like, I think that's something that fascinates me too, like with a royal character, like this idea of royalty and who gets it and what it means. And like this idea that she has this birthright, but like, she doesn't have a lot of respect. And this idea, like how in some spaces you have power and some spaces you don't, which is something both the characters will grapple with as kind of the idea who is more powerful between the two of them shifts around through the book.
Yeah.
And so we definitely see Karina, like she starts to realize like, oh, I'm technically in charge of the city, but like, what does that mean when the people don't really respect you? So.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. And it played really well because yeah, like you say, you've got these two characters and one of them in theory is way at the top of the social order and one is way at the bottom. And yet, depending on where they are, they do kind of the balance of power is constantly shifting between them, which just makes it even more intense. So I want to go back to this idea that the whole element of Karina needing to kill Malik didn't come into the story for a few drafts because that made me really curious about the riddle aspect. Both mm-hmm. books in the series are playing with a riddle and the answer mm-hmm. to the riddle will do this magical spell ritual thing.
It's true. You're right.
Yes. And so I'm curious, because I myself am terrible at riddles, but I love them in fiction. I just find the idea of them fascinating. It's almost like a prophecy in some ways, where there's different interpretations and whatnot. When you were coming up with the riddles, did you like write the riddle first and then figure out, okay, well, now what does that mean? And how do I work that into the story? Or did you figure out what you were going to do in the story and then go back and write the riddle to play off of it?
It's somewhere in the middle of that. I'm kind of a discovery writer. Like, if I need something, I'll write it in the moment, even if I had made no reference to it earlier. And then later, just I'll go back and like set the foundation for the thing I made up at the moment. So when I got to the point where like the plot was starting to move and I was like, okay, we need sort of steps to figure this out, a riddle just made a lot of natural sense, because it also really tied in culturally really well. There's lots of like sort of riddles and phrases with double meanings in African folklore. So that it's culturally, it worked really well. And then plot wise, it helps give like very clear steps, like do these things in these order and you're moving closer to your goal. So the riddle it was more of a plot device for me, if anything else. But I definitely started at the end, because I'm also very bad at, I'm bad at solving them and I'm bad at writing them.
Me too.
Like, I'm always like, man, wait, what? So I started at the end. I'm like, look, this is like a spell, a riddle to bring someone back from the dead. What type of things would bring a person back from the dead? Well, you usually need to trade a soul for a soul. So you're going to need another person. That makes sense. Just sort of other things like this flower, that where does the flower grow? Oh, the flower grows among dead people. That makes sense. Like stuff like that. So just sort of like reverse engineering, like this is what I need. So like, this is how I'm going to make it. Cause yeah, if I start from the other end, I'll just be like, I don't know.
What does that even mean?
Exactly.
Did you ever feel like you had kind of backed yourself into a corner that you then weren't entirely sure how are the characters going to get out of this one?
Oh, definitely. All the time. That's like, Race actually took like 6 rewrites. Cause like,
that's pretty much my writing process right there.
But actually, so one of like my pros and cons as a writer, as my editor always tells me, is that I don't tinker. I can't tinker. Cause like, I will get so lost. Like if I'm just like fiddling with like a paragraph or like fiddling with like a single scene, like I get very lost. And so I'm always sort of working with drafts as like the whole chunk, right? And so that'll mean like if there's a huge like kind of structural problem throughout the book, rather than like, I know some writers like they'll go and they'll only target the scenes where that structural problem like shows up, right? Which makes a lot of sense on paper, but like in my head, because every scene is so informed by the last scene, like it's not, you can't just like, to me, like edit those scenes where the issue comes up, because every scene after it should in theory be affected by it. So like when there's a problem, I have to just go and start over. And so I will start over the whole thing. And because in my head, a story is like a braid, like, you know how like a braid has 3 different strands and you can only ever see 2 strands at a time. But like the 3rd strand is still there, right? Even when you're not seeing it, like, and so unraveling it just takes, you got to unravel the whole thing if there's an issue at any point in the braid. So for me, no, it's definitely like, I just have to start over. I have to like work on it as a whole and see it as a whole. So by the end, I tend to have something very cohesive, but it definitely takes a lot of, ooh, we made one mistake in chapter 3, so the whole thing has to go. Oh, sorry.
So I'm really curious, because in book 2, we're still following these 2 main characters. We're still alternating chapters back and forth. But at the start of the book, like they are on 2 very separate paths. They're now on 2 different locations. Did you kind of, like you were saying, like braid it back and forth and like go from chapter to chapter very chronologically there? Or were you ever like, I'm just going to follow Malik for a few chapters and see what happens. And okay, now I'm going to switch back over to Karina for a few chapters.
So I always write it in the alternating, because number 1, I'll definitely lose the balance of chapters if I don't do that. And number 2, just because like, ideally, like what I'm going for is that like, even when like Karina's on the other side of the continent, what happened in her last chapter is informing Malik, whether directly or indirectly, because there's, even if they're just sort of echoing each other, because they're on very sort of similar, if different, journeys. And so for me, like, And also, like, if I accidentally say wrote just Malik for a while, I might have like five very intense chapters in a row. But then if I also have five very intense Karina chapters, now I just have like 10 chapters in a row that are just go, 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 go. Like, there's no moment of stopping. So I have to make sure, like, even though they both have their own very distinct story arcs, they're still like a rhythm to the story as a whole, you know?
Yeah, no, that actually makes a ton of sense. And I having, you know, just read it, I can see how that all kind of informed each other and worked. And I just love seeing into other writers' heads and processes. That really makes a lot of sense.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like every writer is like, look, I wouldn't suggest my process, but this is what I do.
I definitely want to talk a little bit about world building, because this is a very rich, very complex world that you've developed. There's a lot of history and a lot of mythology. You know, there's this idea of gods who kind of play a big part over the course of the story. And one of the things that I particularly loved was just how many like different festivals and celebrations you talk about and how they all have, you know, different meanings for different people. And it just made it all feel just super lush and very real. So when you first had this idea and you were first getting started, what were some of the steps that you took to develop the world? And how much of it did you maybe have planned out beforehand versus how much kind of was developed as you were writing?
Oh, sure. So for me, I knew from the start, I was like, even when I was thinking sort of West African culture, I sort of knew like I need to like kind of narrow down, because like Africa is a very big continent. No one can write one book that can like capture every culture. I certainly can't. Mm-hmm. So I was like, let me think a specific region, a specific period in time and go from there. And so I knew I ended up going with sort of the Trans-Saharan trade route in the 11th to 12th century, simply because that was one of the big sort of pre-colonial eras where we saw lots of big kingdoms in like West and North Africa, like the kingdom of Mali, Songhe, like ancient Ghana. Those were happening and they had like some Game of Thrones level like things going on there. It was great. But so I knew them. So when I had sort of taken that little slice, I'm like, this particular place and this particular time is my sort of framework. It sort of then sort of created the foundation for everything that came next. So once I had my sort of setting basis, I kind of started there. And then I really wanted the world to feel very lived in. Like like we mentioned, I come from a fanfic background. And so I love the type of stories that like have like a single small detail that like comes in the book and then fans like bring like 8,000 words of headcanon over this one small detail. Like I wanted to give lots of small details and Easter eggs and like this feeling like the world existed before the characters and the world's going to exist after the characters was very big to me. So I knew like the way you do that is like you give it so much history, you give it so much like all of these little things that like happen that don't necessarily have anything to do with Malik and Karina, because so much happens in our own world that has nothing to do with you or me, but it's still going on in tandem to whatever we have going on. Mm. So there's so many little things that like there's another story happening clearly to the left of the characters and like they're noticing it, but like it's just not really important to the reader at the moment, but it's there. So I was definitely adding a lot of that. So like the small details to make the world feel lived in. And then I think the sense of history, like this idea that like everything that's happened now is because something else happened in the past. And like this feeling, like I'm very fascinated with the idea of destiny versus free will, especially in books, and like how much of this is happening because it's supposed to and how much is because people made it happen. And so we definitely see, I think that comes up more in book two as Malik and Karina sort of realize some things about not even like their past, but like their family's ancient past that sort of led to this moment. And they start to realize like maybe some creatures have been pulling the strings more tightly than they realized. Mm. And so I knew this idea that like, I want to set up a world where readers could get in a strong argument. Was all of this going to happen no matter what Malik and Karina did? Or did all of this happen because of what they did? And so kind of when I had those three pillars in mind, like this is the kind of world I want to make. I think it all came together very naturally there.
Mm-hmm. No, it really does. It feels just very woven together, I would say.
Exactly, like the braid.
Are there a braid? Exactly. It's a perfect analogy for all things. do you have like aspects of world building that you particularly enjoy? or alternatively, aspects of world building that you like really hate or really struggle with?
Ooh, so can I give the same thing as an answer to both of those?
For sure. Me, yeah.
A magic system. I love like a
good, I know like, exactly what you mean.
I love a good detailed magic. I actually especially love magic systems with rules. I love magic systems where there's a cost and like where the characters just can't like sort of shoot infinite magic into the space or whatever. But it's very difficult to write. Like I've now had this problem. So I'm currently working on my next series, which is a middle grade series, and it has a harsher magic system than Wraiths, even though it's middle grade, which I find very funny. And I'm dealing with that now. And I'm like, I thought by this series, I would have figured out not to write myself in the corner like this. Oh no. Like, there's just that feeling of like, on one level, magic should be able to do whatever it wants. And like, it's supposed to be fantastic. You're supposed to be able to pull off like things you can't pull off in the real world. But on the other level, when your characters can do anything, it lowers like readers' investment because they're just like, why don't they just use magic to get themselves out of the well or whatever? So you have to strike that balance between creating something that's like so awe-inspiring and so big that breaks all the rules, but has enough rules that like it still can't be a solution for every problem. Like, yeah. Honestly, I think the best series is when magic kind of makes things worse and like it just causes more problems than it solves. And I tried to strike that balance in Wraiths. Like, Malik and Karina, well, Karina especially, is turning to magic to solve her problems, but it's also kind of making everything worse for her. And as she learns as the story goes on, it's kind of the source of most of her problems to begin with.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. It's just nothing but trouble.
Exactly. Because I'm like, yeah, you can have like these literal like God level powers, but you have to be ready to like deal with God level consequences.
Mm. That's like a great quote right there. That is very quote worthy. Okay. I'm so excited that you brought up your middle grade, because I wanted to ask you about that, but in general, you are very busy for what I can tell. So A Psalm of Storms and Silence just came out. And then my understanding is that you have 3 books out next year. True?
That's what they tell me. Just cry a single tear.
So I want to know a little bit more about them, but before we get there, I would just love if you have any tips or suggestions for balancing so many projects.
Definitely. I think the thing for me is like, number one, if you don't have a time management plan, get one. And I say that as someone who's like, is very, very, very bad at this type of thing. Like, like if you're like, your system is like writing stuff in a planner or a bullet journal or Google Calendar or like someone who calls you and yells at you whenever you don't finish something, I don't know, it can be whatever you want, but you gotta get one. Because like, I tried to juggle things in my head at like maybe the first couple months and it ended badly. So like, definitely get an organizational system. For me, I use Google Calendar and I color code it, and it has saved my life on many occasions. That's the first tip. On a craft level, I definitely think is allowing yourself to kind of have a different headspace for every project, in the sense that like when I'm working on Serwa, that's the middle grade, versus when I was working on the Black Panther or when I'm working on the Star Wars story, I'm a very different headspace for each of them. And the way I access them tends to be music, because each of them has a different sort of vibe. And so like with Serwa, I listen to lots of like, it's very comic book and cartoon inspired. So I listen to lots of cartoon music, anime, like lots of high action, like high like energy sort of things. Versus Black Panther is obviously like Black Panther, superhero. So I'm listening to lots of superhero soundtracks. I'm listening to lots of Afro beats. I'm listening to like things that make me think of like that property. And with Star Wars, it's obviously the Star Wars soundtrack, because it's Star Wars.
Like, what else are you going to listen to?
Exactly. And with Wraiths, when I was working, I never really had like a set playlist. Because I'm the type of person, I'll listen to one song on loop till a chapter is done, even if that song has actually nothing to do with the chapter. It's more about the vibe of the song. So with Wraiths, it was a lot more like sort of tense, like sort of very big, like sort of festival celebration music, and a lot of love songs because they're super sappy and I'm super sappy. So lots of stuff, and very emotional, because it's at its core, it's a very emotional story. Mm-hmm. So like allowing to give each project this kind of headspace makes it easier to shift between them. Because like if I tried to write like the middle grade with the Wraiths headspace, the middle grade would end up very stabby. That would be bad. So there's definitely about that, like being able to shift, like, what does this story need from me? And being able to quickly shift into those modes.
I love that tip. The idea of using music is kind of like a doorway into these different, you know, spaces in your brain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. With that, and you've obviously given us some hints, but do you want to tell listeners a little bit about all the things you've got coming up?
Sure, definitely. I'm just going to go chronological order here. The next thing I have after Psalm is I have a Black Panther graphic novel coming out with Marvel and Scholastic Books in spring 2022. I'll have more details. Hopefully by the time this airs, they'll be out on the cover and the title. But what I can say right now is that it features a young Shuri and T'Challa on a quest to save their mother and Wakanda from a curse. And I think it was just so fun getting to write like these two iconic characters as kids, because so much of the content on them is as adults. And as kids, they actually didn't like each other that much, which is I learned through my research. So it was very fun exploring how these two very different siblings who didn't get along became the very tight-knit adults we see in the movies and the comics. So that's spring 2022. And then June 7th, 2022, I have a story in the anthology Stories of Jedi and Sith, which is just a collection of 12 different writers writing middle grade short stories about various characters on the Jedi side and the Sith side of the great Star War, if you will. Are you allowed to call that the Star War? I don't know. But like the great
canon battle. The and fandom I is can't... decided. What a cool idea for an anthology. I love that.
Yes. And like, technically, I can't officially say who I'm writing. But like,
I was just going to ask. That was my next question. So,
yeah. I mean, if you do some digging, some very like sharp-eyed fans have figured it out, which I cannot confirm or deny, but like, technically, you'll find out officially soon.
Okay.
So that's that. And then the third one is Serwa Boateng's Guide to Vampire Hunting. That's out fall 22 with Rick Riordan Presents. And that should also hopefully have a cover coming in the next couple months or so. So this one, it takes place, and it's actually a contemporary fantasy, this one. And it follows a young girl who has been trained in a secret society of vampire hunters to fight a very specific kind of vampire called an Azay. It's a kind of creature we have in Ghanaian folklore, which instead of turning into a bat, it turns into a firefly. And their main feature is they actually take over their host's mind. So they possess you and they force you to drink blood and do bad things. So yeah, very bad. So she and her family have been fighting them for generations. She knows all about combat, first aid, blah, blah. But when a bunch of Azay attack her home, her family decides, nope, this is too dangerous. You cannot do this anymore. And they dump her with her aunt in Maryland, where she has to go to human school for the very first time in her life. And so Serwa learns that while she's prepared to be a vampire hunter, she's actually not prepared for seventh grade. And then when one of the vampires actually infiltrates her school, she has to turn to her normal human classmates for help. And she now has to train a bunch of human children into the art of vampire hunting before they all get eaten. So it's a very fun story. It's very inspired by cartoons and obviously Ghanaian folklore. And I grew up in Maryland, so I get to take lots of pot shots in my hometown, which is great. Like, I love them, but it's a very funny place. So that one's a lot of fun. Right now, I'm working on my very last edits on that one. So that's great.
Oh my gosh, that sounds super fun. And that is all so exciting. I am sending you much good luck and happy inspiration for the next 12 months.
This was not all supposed to come out this close. It all just kind of happened, especially with Psalm. Like, Psalm was originally planned for June of 2021, and then like various circumstances happened and it got got pushed to November. So like, it is a coincidence that I ended up with this many publications like this close together. So yeah.
You'll get it. It'll be fine. It's all good stuff.
I know, it's all very, very busy. Funny. Exactly.
Okay. Are you ready for our bonus round?
Yes.
Okay. Writing in the morning or writing at night?
Writing in the morning, if I can actually remember to get up, because I hate getting up in the morning, but I like being up in the morning.
It's a small distinction.
Yes.
Sunny beach or snowy mountains?
Oh, sunny beach. I hate the cold. Like, I respect it aesthetically, but I don't want to be in the cold.
What is your favorite writing snack?
Ooh, I got really into like salami over the pandemic. I'm not sure why, because it also makes it very hard to type, because like you eat salami and they have to like wipe your hands, and you eat when you gotta wipe your hands. Exactly. But it's very good. And it's like, I don't know, I think maybe the sodium or something. I don't know.
What is your favorite writing beverage?
Ooh, I really like seltzer. I'm one of those weirdos who actually enjoys seltzer water. So like
I like seltzer. Oh, me too. I love it.
It's like the fun of soda without having to worry about rotting your teeth.
Yeah. If you had one of the elemental alignments that are in your books, which one would you have and why?
So the fun thing about the alignments is it actually corresponds to our world. And I think on Epic Reads, they had the whole breakdown of like, if you were born this day, you have this one. So I was born Saturday. So that one's fire, which I think is funny because I don't think personality wise, I align with that one, but technically it would be fire. Personality wise, I think I'd have water if I got to pick, but in their world, you don't get to pick. So
back to being like Mercury.
Yeah, exactly. But I want to be Venus.
I have no idea what day of the week I was born on. Now I want to go find out.
It's super easy. Like you can put online, you put in your birth date, they'll give you the exact one.
Sure. What advice would you give to help someone be a happier writer?
I definitely think the best thing about being a happier writer is giving yourself like permission to take your writing seriously. Because I always tell aspiring writers, like, if you want to play if you want to play in the Olympics, you have to be practicing at Olympic level long before you make the team. In a sense that I know so many people who are like, oh, I want to write, but like, I don't have time. Or like, I feel like I'm wasting time when I'm writing, when I have schoolwork or work or family stuff to do. But in the same way, like when an Olympic athlete or like someone training for it says, sorry, I have practice right now, I can't come hang out or I can't do this thing, you're allowed to say like, hey, this is my writing time I scheduled out for this week. I'm actually not available during this time. And I know it sounds weird because a lot of people feel like until you have the agent or the book deal, like you can't take your writing seriously. But I know in my case, like it was when I took the writing seriously and I started sort of like treating it like a practice that like was very important to me, that actually my writing improved to the point then that book deal and the agent were very possible. Mm-hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to write every single day, but it does mean that when you are making time to write, like you are putting it whatever rhythm works for you and your schedule, but like a consistent, it's more consistency rather than every single day. And for some people, consistency is every day or it's every other day or every week, but as long as that's there. So yeah, give yourself permission to treat your writing as seriously as you would a sport or any other hobby, because that's the best way to get to a place where like you can reach the next level.
That is excellent, excellent advice. And I know that it is really hard for people to do that. I feel like even as a published, like this is my job and I still struggle sometimes to prioritize it. So it's a skill, but yeah, really, really important.
Definitely, definitely.
What book makes you happy?
Oh gosh, I love that because that's like, there's so many kinds of happy. And I'm just trying to think, a book that makes me happy would probably be, oh, okay. So this one makes me happy because like it means a lot to me from when I was a child. The Tale of Despereaux by Kathy Camillo. Mm. I was obsessed with that book back in elementary school. I have like, my old copy is like all worm bitten and like nasty and I love it so much. And so probably the kid, and he's just a little mouse and he's going on an adventure to save a princess. Just think about it, right now is making me go, oh. Oh, and Ella Enchanted. Gail Carson Levine, oh my God, Ella Enchanted is just think about, oh, now I want to go read Ella Enchanted after this.
I love Ella Enchanted. And that is one that I think has been mentioned maybe more than any others on this podcast. It clearly has impacted a lot of people.
Yes. And I think it falls in that weird category that doesn't really exist anymore between middle grade and YA.
Yeah.
I feel like, yeah, if she was trying to sell that in 2021, I'm not sure like when an agent be like, this is a middle grader, this is a YA, I'm not sure where they categorize it.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. Huh. Lastly, where can people find you?
Oh, definitely. So I'm at Rosie's Rambles. So that's R-O-S-I-E-S Rambles on both Twitter and Instagram, though I'm honestly more active on Twitter because I'm one of those weirdos who actually really likes that site. So I tend to talk about cartoons and like anime more than books, but I talk about books too. So yeah, come say hi. I am very active because I like to go there to avoid my deadlines.
All of your many, many, many deadlines.
Many, oh, they just, another one just pops out of the snow like every other day.
Awesome. Roseanne, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. No, this has been very, very fun.
Readers, please check out A Psalm of Storms and Silence. It is out now. Of course, we always encourage you to support your local indie bookstore if you can. If you don't have a local indie, you can check out our affiliate store at bookshop.org/shop/Marissa Meyer. Next week, it's a fairy tale retelling themed episode. I am excited to talk with Jennifer Donnelly, author of Stepsister and Poisoned, and we will be talking about both her awesome retellings and my new novel, Gilded. I hope you will join us. If you're enjoying these conversations, please subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Marissa Meyer Author and at Happy Writer Podcast. Until next time, stay healthy, stay cozy, and whatever life throws at you today, I do hope that now you're feeling a little bit happier.